Our next guest has gained a reputation for creating stories. Octavio Solis is a playwright and one well known to audiences of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. But his latest published work is not a play, and it's not someone else's story. It is his own. A series of stories from his past can make a reader laugh or cringe and a whole lot of things in between. They are contained in a book called Retablos, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border. As I mentioned, Octavio Solis writes plays usually, and by the bucket load, it seems. He's visited the Exchange several times before to talk about his work, including Mother Road, which will have its world premiere at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in March. Octavio Solis, always good to have you in front of a microphone here.
Well, thank you very much for asking me back.
Your life informs all of your work, but have you written this directly about your life before this time?
No, I've always shied away from it. I always felt like it was taboo, like I couldn't touch it. Mm-hmm. I thought that, well, first of all, I didn't think my life was that interesting. But secondly, I just felt that that I was too close to it. I had so many mixed feelings about it, but finally, I felt that I had to purge these things. They just came to me in dreams, and when some of these images came to me, I kept relegating them to dreams. I thought they didn't really happen, so I felt I had to write them down. Or else they would become fiction, complete fiction.
Are there things that sort of rattle? I mean, as a writer's mind, I have to believe that there are ideas that you finally just have to put on paper because otherwise they're going to go around in your head like marbles or something.
Exactly, and they had been for a long, long time, but in the end, I thought that maybe they would be worth something, if not to me, to the public. That. I had to translate them into story rather than just make them strictly autobiographical details. So I gave myself the freedom to expand around them.
So I love the phrase in your intro about every memory has a patina of invention on it. What does that mean?
It means that every time we revisit a memory, we change it a little. We remember it differently. We tell it differently. And there's a little more fiction over it. That we just keep putting over the memory every time we revisit it, and that sort of tells me that in the end all history is a kind of fiction, and once I thought of it that way, I felt like I could write about these stories in the end. I could write about myself in that way if I thought of them as little stories.
And so little stories and retablos are not – so how does that work together? Retablos means what? It's an actual physical thing.
Well, a retablo is a kind of votive images, a very sacred image that's painted by naive artists on beaten tin or a piece of metal or even a license plate. And they date back to the early 20th century. And it was a way for people to kind of give thanks to the particular saint or the Virgen de Guadalupe or someone, to some holy figure for saving them at a time when they really begged for help, when they needed help. And it could have been a transgression like an assault or an accident, a car accident, or the family pig dying or somebody falling ill. But then their pleas were answered, and so they make these images as a kind of thanks in which the story is written out, but there's at least one or two images that sort of illustrate what happened. So I think of them as almost like an early form of flash fiction.
Mm-hmm. But so it's like an incident you got past. I mean, this was an incident that caused it was an upheaval in life. That kind
yes,
of thing.
Yes, an upheaval, a rift, something that happened that shook the person's life and rattled them to their core. That they had to plead to God or some saint for some kind of succor, aid, help, saving something to save them.
We were talking about the patina of invention, and when I imagine that it's getting thicker as time goes on, as you mentioned. But you had me laughing though when you were talking about the possible influence of lithium present in El Paso's water when you grew up.
Well, I learned about that shortly after I moved away. I moved away when I went to college, and at age 18, my parents are still there, and I have brother and sister that are still there, so I visited often. But it wasn't until after I moved away that I read that they had found very, very low traces, but significant traces of naturally occurring lithium in the drinking water. which accounts for a kind of just very slow, easygoing pace to life in El Paso. Everyone just takes it a little easier there.
Did you go back to El Paso at all? Did you try to immerse yourself once again in some of the the memories to try to recapture them?
Every time I go back home, I do that. Between the time that I left and I would say the last 10 years, El Paso had changed very little. It seemed frozen in time. It still seemed like it was trapped in the early 70s. A lot of that was because of an economic downturn from which El Paso has had a hard time recovering. But in the last 10 years, it's really changed. It's really sort of feels like part of the U.S. again.
Is it kind of a post-NAFTA thing or something?
I think so. Mm-hmm. But it still feels somewhat isolated. It's so isolated from the rest of the country in the same way that Juarez feels isolated from the rest of Mexico. The two of the cities feel like they're leaning on each other for some kind of, identity, for some kind of communal cultural identity, even though there's that river that kind of scars this place between them. These two cities feel like they're part of another country, an in-between country, a kind of a land that is in the interstice between first world and third world.
It is interesting how you let us know about El Paso, though, but not so much as like, well, here's the city and here's the square and I describe it. You really just describe your life and we sort of get glimpses of, as you, the younger Octavio, moves through the town, what it's like.
Yeah, I didn't feel like I had to explain a lot. I wanted the details of each retablo to sort of add up to something as you read along. So you get a sense of the entire city by the time you're done with all the retablos. The less explaining I had to do, the better I felt about the kind of El Paso I was creating, which was a more of an El Paso of the mind, an imaginary place.
And most of the stories are about two or three pages long. They're contained in retablos, stories from a life lived along the border. Octavio Solis, the well-known playwright, is the author of this and our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back to the conversation here in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio, we have the playwright Octavio Solis, well known to audiences at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, with us once again. This time, though, he's not writing about Edward III or relatives of Tom Joad or the other characters that he's put on stage or will be soon. The Tom Joad references to Mother Road, which premieres at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in March. He writes about himself in a book called Retablos, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border. He did, in fact, grow up in El Paso, of Mexican parents. We'll get a lot further into the story, and you can join the conversation on The Exchange as we explore the life of Octavio Solis as told in retablos. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The way that you mentioned the patina, that as we revisit memories, you know, that our later selves are reinterpreting what happened back then, and the way that later memories influence earlier ones comes through right away. The way you describe your parents laughing loud and hoarse, and yet how do you think this will be the same sound that you'll hear when one of them cries for the other at the end?
Because they were crying. There was hearing them laugh in that large, horsey way reminded me of an earlier time, took me right back to an earlier time when I heard them weeping in that same way over a pair of canaries. And that also then, I could hear that same kind of sound projected into the future, because we can all, once we become aware of our own mortality, we start thinking immediately of our parents' mortality, and that retablo kind of took me to the past and the future.
I want to point out to the audience again, your parents are still alive, so
we're
good for the moment. Okay, and so you do still have family in El Paso, and I've been back there a bunch of times. Let's talk about your mother way back, though, because she was apparently quite young when she got pregnant with you.
Yes, she was really young. I think she was 16 at the time, she was living in Juarez. She was living with my grandmother, and my grandmother said that she didn't want them to get together, but since they were, she said, I'll let you two get married if you move to El Paso. I want my grandchildren to be Americans. And she'd already been commuting. My grandmother had already been commuting to El Paso to do housework. But now it was a matter of bringing her daughter and my father. my mom and dad with them to El Paso.
This is Mama Concha.
Mama Concha. Yeah, uh-huh. She was a very powerful, very strong figure in my past.
And very, very hard on your father, it sounds like.
Oh, she was really hard on him. She didn't like him, didn't want him. And then it took a while, but she got used to him and then eventually loved him, felt like he was like a son.
Let's get a sense of that time, though. I mean, is this something that happened often where somebody in Mexico would say, you know, you guys need to live over there in the United States, and it was that easy? It was that possible?
Oh, yes, it was really possible. The border was much more fluid. You could take a streetcar from El Paso to Juarez and back. It was in the early days, it was mule-drawn, and a mule would take it all the way into El Paso, into Juarez, and then they just move the mule to the other end side of the streetcar, and then it would come right back. El tranvía, it was called. Uh-huh. It was a much more fluid time. The two cities felt like they were in cahoots with each other. During the Prohibition, many El Paso figures, including the sheriff and a few other well-to-do individuals, would open bars and brothels in Juarez where they could freely sell bourbon and whiskey and things like that. One of the most famous bars in Juarez is known as the Kentucky Club, and it's still there. And it was called the Kentucky Club because it was the only place you could get real Kentucky bourbon.
Wow. And even after, I mean, it stayed open even after the Prohibition ended on the American side?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was still, and there were many businesses that were owned by El Paso citizens and vice versa. There were people who in the United States opened printing presses and newspapers so they could print tracts and then smuggle them into Mexico to aid in the Mexican Revolution.
Wow, a lot of cross-border stuff back then. Your father actually crossed the border quite a bit, as you point out in the book. He worked in Juarez and lived in El Paso, but some point somebody said something, huh?
Yeah, he just kept... He was selling ads for a radio station. So he would get up early in the morning, walk through the checkpoint into Juarez and work. And then at the end of the day, he'd walk back and he'd the same border... guard would see him and finally stopped him. And I said, what are you doing? Where are you going? He says, I'm going to work. He says, where do you live? He says, I live in El Paso, but you work in Juarez. And he said, yeah. He says, you can't do that. You have to decide now and you have to do it right now. Where do you live? Because once you're there, you stay there. And that's when my father decided, well, I have to be here. My wife is here. My child is here. I have to live in El Paso. He says, well, then you stay in El Paso. And thereafter, he had to find another job. He couldn't because he didn't know any English and he had no skills. He was so young. He was 19, 20 years of age. And so he ended up being a dishwasher in a local Greasy Spoon and over the years graduated to cook, to short order cook, and pretty soon he became well known and was very valued and wanted through that whole short order diner kind of circuit that existed in El Paso for a long time. It's still around, but that's how my dad sort of rose through the ranks.
Octavio Solis is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Not a play this time. His book is called Retablos, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border. He writes about himself. And you don't hold back. You use the term, I am an anchor baby.
I'm an anchor baby. I am. But I don't use that word in the way that... That people have been using it in this country in that derogatory, pejorative way. I use it as a way to, I think of myself as an anchor baby in the sense that I anchored my parents. I anchored them when they really needed to know who they were, what they wanted, what kind of life they really needed for themselves. And I anchored their dreams. I pinned them down to something. In the same way that they anchor me now. And I think I mentioned that in Retablos. They anchor me, and I understand more about who I am in this country because of them, because of their struggle. It took them a while, simply because they've been busy working so much, but both of them are now American citizens.
How much did you understand about the border, immigration, the two different countries growing up? I mean, the story Keening brings us in closer. I mean, was that right. one of the ways in which you understood better what the situation was?
Yeah, it was one of the first instances that I had of being really close up to somebody who had crossed the border illegally, who had come across, a border crosser, in my own home. This couple had been wandering through the streets in the middle of the night through a snowstorm. We had a freak snow blizzard that hit El Paso, and it was so icy, so cold, and they had waded across the river through icy water, and they were lost. And they knocked on my parents' door, and they brought them in, and they took care of them. They warmed them up, helped them dry their clothes, warmed their feet. I have this image of my mother in my head that I can't get out, of her stirring rags in a large stew pot over boiling water. She was stirring them, and I thought she was making soup for them. But what it was is she was just heating up some rags for them to kind of put around their feet, because her feet were so cold, they were afraid that she was going to get frostbite.
Wow.
But I was so frightened. I was so small. I would think it was 4 or 5. I was very frightened of this image of this woman who was crying, incessantly crying, and in obvious distress. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know. I was afraid of her. I thought she was almost like a figure of La Llorona. But she was somebody that really just needed help. And then I noticed that she was pregnant, which made it even more dire and more just poignant.
And you have a reflection to the current time, and I'll have to paraphrase you here because we have an FCC license, but the crap on the border never changes. I mean, what do you make particularly of the recent much ado about the caravan or invasion, depending on which perspective you're taking?
Well, you know, I know I said that it never changes, that there will always be people who want to come to this land and want to find a way over, and there will always be people who want to prevent them from coming. That will never change. But in some respects, it has changed. It's gotten worse because it's never come to the point where children have been put in cages. It's never come to the point where the border is starting to get militarized, where they're sending troops there. But I think I think the exodus is happening in this large mass because the border has been so tightened, and they're letting people in legally through asylum programs at such a slow rate that it's gotten dire. And also the situation in Central America, in both Guatemala and El Salvador and Honduras, has just gotten so bad through criminality, poverty, corruption. It's gotten really bad. In Mexico, it's actually gotten better.
Mm-hmm.
And there's less immigration from that country, from Mexico. Some people are actually going back, but it's really pretty bad in those countries. But I remember a time when it was also really bad, not too long ago, mm-hmm. when it was horrible in Mexico.
Right,
when the cartels,
drug cartels and gangs,
The cartels, and especially when the Mexican government declared war on the cartels, that escalated the situation to such an alarming rate that Juarez was a horrible war zone.
That's right. I remember that. Yeah, okay. Yeah, much more to learn about Juarez and El Paso through the writings of Octavio Solis, who grew up in El Paso. His book is called Retablos, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border. And if you'd like to join us on the Jefferson Exchange, you're welcome to take part. Our phone number is 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Okay, the politics of a different time. You sure built up suspense for seeing a political figure in your as a wee lad.
That's in the Shimmer. I didn't know it was a particular day that my grandmother dressed me up, and I didn't know what she was doing and why she was taking me to downtown. But she dressed me up and slicked me up and put me on a bus, and we rode the bus downtown to the Placita de los Lagartos, and it was a plaza that had two live alligators, sometimes three, inside this sort of enclosed fountain area. But there was huge crowds that were gathered there, and it was a melee. I was scared. I was too little to be among them, and I lost her. We got separated, and I got lost. And until finally, she found me and lifted me up and held me aloft, And then I realized why she'd brought me there. It was my first and only glimpse of a president. I saw John F. Kennedy. He came to visit El Paso and was there outside the Hotel Cortez. And people were so exultant. They were shouting, Viva Kennedy, over and over again. And it's etched in my memory. I've never forgotten it. I was little, very, very little. I have a distinct memory of that.
Well, and you provide a distinct memory for us through the way you describe it. And it's an economy of writing. I mean, you're not taking more than two or three pages for this whole description. But, you know, you can sense the huge crowd of the alligators and the water and the sunshine and all the things that would disorient you as a little kid. But and made me wonder, too, when you're writing plays, I mean, you can certainly set the scene, but you also, your major engine here is dialogue. So right. So is it a real liberating thing to be able to not be with the dialogue and just go right to the description?
Oh, yes. It was so liberating. I felt like I could be purely a writer again and feel unfettered and feel like I didn't have to write dialogue with characters and think in terms of drama and conflict and denouement and rising action. Just describe the event. Sometimes even describe a character. Sometimes I would write something that felt more like a character sketch, like when I'm describing Consuelo, our maid who took care of us, mm-hmm. or Demon, the little kid who also we played with when we were little, or describing my brother and his rage when he... When we had a huge falling out as kids. So it was very liberating. I wanted to say this about the retablos, that's that when I first started writing them, they ended up being long. They were like 10 pages long. Mm-hmm. But then I said, trim it down, scale it down. I thought of them as poems. I started writing them, thinking of them as like prose poems, even though there's still a narrative thread through there, so they're not... They don't truly work like poems, but I wanted to use that kind of economy of language, economy of image, of imagery that poetry employs. So my goal was to try to make them as taut and as dense and concise as possible.
Does that take more work than when you're writing long things or just kind of letting yourself go? I mean, to be able to be that compact?
Oh, it took a long time. Mm-hmm. I'd go through drafts and drafts, and sometimes I would write a retablo, leave it alone for 2 weeks, come back to it, trim a page off of it, and then a year later come back to it and trim two more pages off of it.
It's like the opposite of the patina, isn't it? And instead of you developing all these layers of stuff, you're actually whittling away at them.
I am. But it's also because once I write it down, it became a story. And so I said, well, now I have to employ a kind of storytellers, use my storyteller tools on it. I have to trim it. I have to shape it. I have to craft it. And in the crafting of that, it just stops being purely a memory and starts becoming something that belongs to the world, which is a story for the world. And but that was so liberating. Mm-hmm. That was very, very liberating to not feel like I had to... Like I could really indulge in a particular image and take my time with it and not feel like, okay, then what happens? Then what happens?
They are just vignettes. Like there's one called Blood and Coke, which here again with the economy, the title of this particular retablo also sets up what is the most compelling image where these Coke bottles break in the grocery store, and so the Coke on the floor from the broken bottles and your mother's blood are mingling because she gets hit with the glass, and it's an amazing conjuring of that moment.
I know. It still alarms me. I still dream of it. And I wrote that one down because I did have a dream about it. So I, when I was writing it down, I didn't know whether I was writing my dream or whether I was writing my actual memory of the event. I also eschewed talking to my family about these.
Because you didn't want their input.
I didn't want their input because I wanted to know... I wanted my memory of it to be intact, even if it was because I know if I asked my sister, she'd have a completely different angle on it. If I asked my parents, they would say, well, first of all, they'd say, you can't write about that. That's the first thing they would say.
Yeah, don't ask, right?
Don't go there.
Forgiveness,
don't go
not
there.
Permission.
Right. So there's something about visiting a particular memory only through the lens of the writer. It makes it both pure and skewed at the same time.
Skewed your own way, but
skewed
but pure because it is just yours.
Yeah.
I want to come back for just a second because you mentioned the humble beginnings for your family. Your father couldn't do what he was doing in Juarez because he couldn't speak English, so he worked as a dishwasher and a short order cook. But you had a maid?
Yeah, because eventually both my parents had to work. And in our culture, it's quite possible to be able to hire somebody to take care of us, to cook our meals and clean our house for something like $30 a week, which is a lot of money then.
Mm-hmm.
But my parents had no choice. They had to do that. We couldn't be left alone. We were too little.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister often and I often took the duties of taking care of us when my parents were off on running an errand. But when they had to work and they were both gone, we needed somebody to help take care of us. And it was often Consuelo,
mm-hmm.
who was a grandmotherly type, an old woman who, to me, felt more like she was native, like from the mountain, the Cerros mm-hmm. of Mexico. An Indian woman who knew Spanish but was very religious, very devout.
Let me come back and ask more about Consuelo on the other side of a break. Octavio Solis and Retablos here on the Jefferson Exchange, back in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're visiting once again with the celebrated playwright Octavio Solis, whose work is well known to audiences of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. And the world premiere of his Mother Road will be at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in March. Last time I talked to him was about Edward III, which was for the Play On Project, taking old Shakespeare and putting it into modern English. But all that stuff aside, he's now writing about himself. His latest book is called Retablos, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border, about growing up in El Paso, right across the Rio Grande from Juarez. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we explore the life of Octavio Solis. 800-838-3760, or emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. So we were just talking about Consuelo. She was a bit of a mythical figure, it sounds like, in your childhood.
Oh, yeah. She was, we thought of her almost as our grandmother. She was old, but she did all the work in the house. She did all the cooking in her house when my mother had to work. And she took care of us. She disciplined us firmly, but without striking us or anything like that. She was quite gentle and a lovely woman. But there was something about her that seemed mysterious to us because she evoked the old Mexico to us, a pre-colonial Mexico. She had this long braid of hair that she that looked like a steel cable that went down all the way to her back, and once she was done cooking for us and left us to watch our TV and be with our parents, she would isolate herself in a room where she would go and read her Bible and pray. One time I looked in there and I caught her eating an old moldy apple that we'd thrown away, which was, to me, seemed like such a sacred moment. Because I remember that she always said, "Waste nothing of God's. Don't throw. Eat your food."
She said that a lot.
To eat her food. She said, "Waste nothing of God's. You mm-hmm. have to eat this." So that image stuck with me as somebody who was devoted to her own dictums, to following her own dictums that she gave us.
That she felt she did. She lived as she instructed you.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So, how many kids in the family ultimately?
There are four of us.
Mm-hmm.
There was a fifth. I had a brother named Ernesto, who died as an infant, probably from malnutrition. Although I think pneumonia was the named cause.
Mm-hmm.
We were very poor.
Yeah.
And my mother at some point resorted to going to the local church and asked the priest to pray for her baby, who was obviously very ill, and for me. And that priest, Father Gafford, gave my mother money and did it every week. And she didn't tell my dad because he would be too proud to accept money from anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But they needed it. They needed it for milk. My brother did die within the year. But he sort of, I feel him. I'm not really a very spiritual person in the end, But there's something about his, about not just knowing that he was someone. I wrote a retablo called Ernesto, which is about him, about my brother, about seeing someone at the airport who looked so much like him, or my imagined, my imagined image of him, if he had grown to be as old as I was, and I just felt this sort of presence in this man, being everything that I couldn't be, being more of a more the Mexican than that I had hoped to be at one time. He possessed all those virtues, all those qualities, both good and bad, and that stuck with me.
So let's talk about the neighborhood you grew up in, because if you were that poor, you had to live in probably not the best of housing and probably with a lot of people in similar circumstances. Was that a fairly tough neighborhood? You describe at least one fight in the book in the schoolyard or near the schoolyard.
Yeah. That was in a neighborhood in Hacienda Heights that we lived in. It was fairly rough. It was very mixed between Mexican kids and African-American kids. There were conflicts that we had in the 60s with them. We were always fighting. There were always fights that were going on, and I didn't understand why. I didn't understand why things had to be so tribal in that way. But it was the 60s. It was the 60s when there were a lot of race riots. But then we moved to a neighborhood that was much closer to the river, and that changed things for us. That's when I became aware of the people that were walking down the street. By their gait, we could tell that they had come across the Rio Grande. They had walked across, waded across, or sometimes when it was more filled, they would swim across and somehow evade the border patrol that would be parked up on the levee. And we'd see them there. But that was it. My dad was so proud of that little house. He bought it. It was a neighborhood that was with small rooms. Our bedrooms were smaller than this room, but then we had three bedrooms. Four bedrooms. There were four bedrooms. So they were designed, these little houses, for Mexican-American families with large families who needed to afford be able to afford a house like that. And but they were tiny houses, but we still managed to have our own bedrooms, usually. Until we hired Consuelo, then Consuelo got hers, We started bunking up. So we felt a little more prosperous when we moved into that neighborhood, and that neighborhood was almost fully Mexican American, almost completely. There were some Anglo families that lived there and had been there for a while, who were farmers. It had once been all agricultural in that area, but slowly there were little subdivisions that were being made. Even though I remember across the street from us and behind us, there were cotton fields.
I noticed that. Cotton fields you mentioned. Yeah. Actually, we were in with cotton fields one night when somebody came across the river.
Yeah, we used to play hide and seek. And one day I hid in the cotton fields when they were bristling. They were bristling with cotton, and it hadn't been harvested. I remember the cotton being so much taller.
Mm-hmm.
I remember like 6 feet tall, but it's because I was little. I was 8 years old, so it seemed really tall. And I hid in there one time, I ran into a border crosser, some girl who had crossed the border and was changing out of her wet clothes into clothes that she had there in a tote bag. And I saw her as she was changing, and it was both an exhilarating, thrilling time, a little scary though at the same time. But it was an intimate moment that I shared with her without even speaking. We just with looking at each other. And then I realized the gulf between her and me. I realized that I was a child of privilege, that I was hiding because I wanted to hide, and she was hiding because she had to.
Oh, that's a big difference.
That's a huge, huge difference. That I had a command of two languages where she had only the command of one. That she had status and she could walk through, that I could walk through the streets unfettered, but she couldn't. That's when things sort of became very eloquently clear to me.
We have an email here from Jeff in Ashland, who writes, as a former Tucsonan of many years, I wish the rest of the country could understand the dignity and generosity of the Mexican people and remember a time when the border, Nogales in my case, signified a celebration of shared culture rather than that of derision. That again from Jeff in Ashland.
That's absolutely true. I feel that my daughter studied in Tucson at the University of Arizona for a while, and she went on a trip to do some research at an Indian reservation with some of her colleagues as part of a class project. And while she was driving there, she was followed actually very closely by a vehicle, and she didn't know what it was. It looked like a police vehicle, but she wasn't sure. And then it turned on its lights and pulled over, and it was a state trooper, I think they're called there, who really wanted to know what her business was, whether she spoke English, when her birthday was, got everyone's ID, and really, you know, she had borrowed the car, so it wasn't even her own car, but she had a driver's license, and still they kind of just, he just made life a little difficult for her, just because of who she was.
I want to come back to the retablos, yes, because there are just so many amazing ones in here. And there's stuff that even resonates with things I knew growing up, like I love the story about you listening to Herb Alpert, the Tijuana Brass. I still have that album, Whipped Cream and Other Delights. I forgot to bring it in. I was going to show you the vinyl version again. But it inspired you to make yourself a trumpet. How did you do that?
I just got a shoebox lid. And I shaped it into I drew a trumpet on it with a marker, and then with scissors I very carefully cut it out and made sure I kept all the valves intact and the mouthpiece. It was all drawn really well as a one-dimensional thing. And then I colored it with orange markers and yellow markers, and then I'd play Herb Alpert and just play air trumpet to his albums.
But with this two-dimensional trumpet.
With this two-dimensional trumpet by myself. And I was just so infatuated with him. He was like this beautiful man. He was so handsome. And he had these gorgeous women always on his arm, and he had a sly grin. And the music, to me, evoked Mexico. Of course, it turns out he's not even Mexican at all. And a lot of the music is American music with a kind of, you know, Latin flavor. What Now, My Love, songs like that. But also funny songs like Tijuana Taxi. Mm-hmm. I was so uncool. Everyone's listening to Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin. And
you listen to a guy with a trumpet.
And I'm listening to Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. But it connected me to my own imagination and to acting out and playing out the music that I loved. My brothers later got into it as well, as once we started listening to other music. So we started, we made air guitars, cardboard guitars.
And your parents were okay with this? It wasn't like, hey, you messed up a shoebox or anything?
No, they loved it. Uh-huh. They encouraged it. They encouraged dreaming in the house. And so that was sort of like my first sort of entry into the world of the performative arts.
And then the great story in here, though, about reading the Diary of Anne Frank in school, and it sounds like you ended up on a different planet.
It was remarkable. I had never, ever seen a play before. I had done some school play in elementary school, some King Midas thing, but I never took that seriously. It wasn't until I was forced to audition for Diary of Anne Frank by my drama teacher, and cast in the play as Peter Van Damme, and then we sat in a circle and we read the play, and there were all these other students there who had been part of the drama program for some years. I was young; I was a sophomore. I hadn't even done any drama before, and we read the play. And in the course of reading that play, I could feel the walls just evaporating. I could feel the place, this high school gymnasium in El Paso, Texas, suddenly become an attic space in Amsterdam, in wartime Amsterdam. And this Mexican girl, Gracie Martinez, became Anne Frank for my eyes. And I couldn't believe it. And at the end of it, she was crying. She was literally crying. And it was my first entree into theater. And I said at that point, I think I know where I belong. This is it. I don't think I'm doing anything else for the rest of my life. I thought I was an actor, and I pursued that as a career for a while. But really, I was a writer. And I'm still in theater. It's my first love.
Well, and you have, let's talk about Mother Road, which is coming up in March at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. I imagine you've done multiple read-throughs by now. Has there been actually rehearsal already?
We haven't started. We start in January. Mm-hmm. January 15th, I believe, is the date that we begin with Bill Rausch at the helm. We've done some workshops. We did one workshop, in fact, in September.
But this is a descendant of the Tom Joad from The Grapes of Wrath?
That's how I'm approaching this, as a kind of sequel to The Grapes of Wrath. I'm imagining that Tom Joad, who had, in the novel just walks away from his family because he has to, disappears. We don't know what's become of him, but he's a wanted man. And I thought, where would a wanted man in California go? But Mexico. I thought he would go to Mexico and try to start a new life there. And that after one generation, two generations, three generations later, his descendants, his offspring, come to work the fields in California again. And that one of them is handpicked, the last remaining survivor of the Tom Joad family tree is handpicked to now run a farm back in Salisaw, Oklahoma.
Oh, wow. There is the story. So back to Oklahoma in Mother Road by Octavio Solis. We've been talking about his memoir, in a sense. It's called Retablo, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border. Octavio Solis, always a pleasure. Thanks for visiting.
Jeffrey, thank you very much. And thank you for reading the book. I really appreciate that.
Pleasure's mine.